Hello, this week's Brewing Podcast is with me, Guy Foster, speaking to Mike Riddle and Kasper Brzeźniak, who comprise the Allianz Macro Unconstrained team, and it's not intended as investment advice. We're going to be talking about the apparent disagreement between equity and bond markets over the outlook, but bear in mind that we can't guarantee sources from outside Brew and Dolphin. Tax legislation and allowances can change. And remember, Mike and Kasper expect the wall of stimulus that we're seeing at the moment to drive an economic recovery. But when investing, your capital is at risk. Investment values may increase or decrease as a result of currency fluctuations, and we may hold any of the securities mentioned. And future performance may differ from that of the past. Now, with that said, let's get on with the podcast. Hello, everybody. Welcome to another Brewin podcast at what is a very interesting time for markets. And with it being such an interesting time, I'm delighted that I am joined by Mike Riddell and Kasper Brzeźniak of the Allianz Macro Unconstrained team, the managers of the Strategic Bond Fund and the Gilt Fund. So, guys, thanks very much for joining us. I think the obvious place to start is that we're in a situation right now where we've got the bond market performing quite well, yields quite low, so a lot of strength in the bond market, seeming therefore to kind of discount quite a bad economic outlook. And yet at the same time, I think what's puzzling a lot of people is the equity markets are also quite strong and therefore seem to be discounting quite a good outlook. And I wondered, is that a circle that you can square, or do you think one of these markets is ultimately going to be proven wrong?
A key question to what we do with our funds, and particularly our strategic bond fund, because as macro top-down investors, we invest in the full suite, really, of global macro instruments. We do rates, credit, inflation, and currencies. And it's exactly this point that we look for, is when different markets are pricing in different macro outcomes. And as you rightly say, right now we are seeing that. We are seeing government bond yields extremely low. We can get onto gilts later, but 7-year gilt yield went negative recently. So the market's not pricing in any rate hikes for the whole cycle, essentially, for the next cycle, wherever that takes us. And credit spreads have rallied back. As you say, equities have rallied, and risky assets are having a pretty good time and have almost recouped the losses that we saw from Q1. So our market's pricing in a different outlook? Yes, definitely. But what I would say is that this has been the case for a while. And actually, if you looked at when we entered this year, and in fact, we did a podcast with you back in the middle of January, when we entered this year, government bonds then were also pricing in risks of recession, when actually other markets were not pricing in any risk of recession whatsoever. So it's a little bit of a return to where we were at the beginning of this year. Which one's right? I'd say we're somewhere in between the two. I think government bond yields are obviously extremely low, and that's because interest rates have been slashed, and that's because central banks are doing QE. So can you justify yields being low at the moment? I'd say yes. But does that worry me? Then also yes, because I think that you're going to see, and we can get to this, a very strong rebound in the global economy is most likely outcome for us. And that means that government bonds at some point are going to become vulnerable. If you have growth of, say, 5% annualized and inflation jumping above target, which actually is what we think might happen by Q2 or Q3 of next year, then government bonds could come under a lot of pressure. But does that mean they're going to sell off now? I'd be surprised, because there's massive stimulus and the Fed is determined to keep yields very low. And there's no way anyone's going to hike rates this year or probably even next year. But then markets aren't going to look that far ahead. So I think government bond yields can stay at these levels for a bit longer, but I don't think they're cheap. And I agree, they are pricing in a bad long-term outlook, not just a bad near-term outlook. And then it comes down to risky assets and whether you can justify valuations there. If you look at credit markets, IG Credit has obviously had a huge sell-off in February and March and has rallied back most of the losses that you experienced. But there is still some bad news priced in. I wouldn't say that it's pricing in no recession. If you look at triple B's or high yield, or if you look at EM debt, for example, then it's clearly still historically cheap when you view it as a spread over the risk-free rate, at least anyway. So I think it's still pricing in some bad news. Equities, I can't comment too much, but I'd say that that's consistent with the credit rally you've seen. You can look at other asset classes or currencies like Australian dollar. They've recouped really all the losses that they had in February and March. So I think that's consistent with the equity story. And you know, they're pricing in a rosy global outlook. Of course, the global economy right now is very weak, but markets look 6 months ahead. So that is probably consistent with what we think, which is that the global economy will have a strong bounce back and lots of monetary stimulus, lots of fiscal stimulus. And for a while, we had free energy. In fact, we actually had negative priced energy for a bit, which means that you should have a very strong global recovery in Q3 and Q4, assuming, of course, that the virus does not become a bigger issue again in the next few months. You see the same thing in implied volatility in currencies, or inflation-linked bonds have done well, break-evens have picked up. So the global reflation story is definitely being played out in markets. We think that risky assets are still reasonably priced, but clearly much less so than they were. In terms of whether you can square that circle, I think that how can you justify it? I'd say that, I mean, central bank purchases are the biggest driver of asset prices. And I know that central banks aren't buying equities unless it's the BOJ, but central banks are buying all sorts of assets, and they're deliberately driving down volatility. And that means that risk premium are being compressed, and therefore risky asset prices go up. So I think a lot of it is simply linked to central bank actions. Even the central banks buying US treasuries can help out credit, can help out equities as well, indirectly. So that's what you historically see, is lots of QE, lots of asset purchases is good for risky assets. When central banks start putting their tapping the brake with their feet, then that's normally bad for risky assets, credit spreads, equities, with around a kind of 3 to 6 month lag.
Okay, I mean, that's a useful segue then. So you did make some comments there about the outlook for policy. Obviously, the most recent thing in terms of policy for the UK has been an expansion of quantitative easing, but a slowing of the pace of purchases. So, I mean, should you consider that to be this tapping of the brakes that you mentioned?
Potentially a little, yes. And I was actually a little bit surprised that they did slow the pace as much as they did, given that the outlook is far from clear at the moment. I would, in terms of gilt yield specifically, I think the key point to make about this is, and we had the same debate and argument in 2009, and we've had it consistently since then, is if you're looking at the level of gilt yield, key thing to bear in mind is not the amount of supply, the gross supply, it's the net supply that matters. So why did gilts rally when we had the biggest amount of issuance that we've ever seen? That's because the Bank of England didn't just eat all the gilts that were supplied, they ate more than all the gilts that were supplied. So there was net negative supply. You know, demand was bigger than supply, so prices go up and yields go down. But, you know, looking forward, and as I said earlier, that when central banks start to slow the pace of QE, you know, it's the rate of change that really matters here. And when you look at things like credit spreads, for example, that a slowing of global QE, if you add up all the central banks' assets around the world, that tends to lead credit spreads by about 3 to 6 months, and indeed leads actually even inflation expectations as well. So if you see a slight relative tightening of liquidity, and even though it's extremely loose still, but it's not as loose as it was, then that tends to be not so rosy for risky assets, and we'd expect to see inflation expectations drop down. So it does concern me a little bit. I think not for right now, given that there tend to be lags involved, but it could be a situation where towards the end of this year, maybe a bit more pressure on risky assets.
And the other thing that that we've had sort of in the sphere of policy is that a few weeks ago, the members of the MPC just seemed to go on a bit of a crusade to convince the market that they were openly considering negative interest rates as a policy response. I'm not sure from the people I've spoken to whether anyone really took that seriously. But I mean, do you think this is something that we could see in the UK?
I think the markets generally did take it seriously because it was a complete change of direction from the Bank of England. They've consistently said that they wouldn't go negative rates, although over the last few years they have changed what they'd say is the lower bound. So a few years ago they said 0.25%, and then last year they said, oh, we won't go below plus 0.1. So now it's not very consistent, but they said that So, you know, we could, in theory, go negative rates. We don't want to rule it out. But I think people were taking a bit of a leap, a logic leap, and saying, oh, that means that they are going to do it. So there was a quite a big rally in front-end gilts on the back of that, because it was a change in information. You know, it was new news. Do I think it will actually happen? I actually, in this instance, actually, I think I take the Bank of England at its word. I struggle to see why they would go negative rates now, when they must have done some work last year to look at whether it's feasible, and then when they came up with a 0.1 as being the floor. I think that they were just, they didn't want to rule out anything, because, and that makes sense. Why would you rule out a policy option? At least have it as an option. You can choose not to choose that, obviously, but to have it as an option at least makes sense. But markets then started pricing in the chance of negative rates, which I guess is consistent with a change in information. Will they go negative rates, though? I'd be surprised. And if you're cynical, actually, you could suggest that, oh, maybe it's a little bit of a coincidence that the Bank of England suddenly started talking about the chance of negative rates, which naturally made gilts rally, just as they do the biggest amount of issuance that we've ever seen from the UK, if you want to be cynical. I'm not sure that's really the true answer. I think it's just literally having further options available. I mean, a lot of it's going to be linked to what happens in terms of the UK economy and the global economy. If we do get a colossal second wave and the whole world goes into lockdown again, which definitely isn't our view, but you know, it could happen, then they need further policy response. Although I think I'd still say even then, more QE would be the preferred option, because given the amount of gilt supply, you know, they have not run out of gilt to buy. In fact, the ownership as a percentage from the Bank of England is no different to where it was at the beginning of this year, you know, given that they've just matched the amount of supply in terms of how much they've bought so far. So, yeah, I think negative rates is unlikely. It's going to be damaging for the banking sector. Although the ECB seems to believe it's been a great policy tool, I think that, you know, as the Fed said, the evidence has been mixed, and I'd concur with that. Maybe the ECB has said it's been a great policy tool because they used it and they want to save face, but and I don't think it has been a terrific policy tool, and I think there are better alternatives.
And then the other change in policy, in inverted commas, I guess, was Andrew Bailey saying his preference for kind of exiting this period of extraordinary easing is to run down the balance sheet. So implying, I guess, unwinding QE before interest rates go up. And that seems quite a change from what Mark Carney used to say, where he seemed to want to get some of those potential rate cuts back in the armory by raising interest rates sooner. Do you think that was had a significant effect on the market?
Yeah, it is interesting. I wouldn't say it's had an effect yet, because unwinding the balance sheet and hiking rates still seem like that it's very far away. So I don't think markets are looking that far ahead at the moment. But yeah, it is an interesting change in policy. Which I guess is, you know, again, like the lower bound for interest rates. You know, when the central bank says something, people will take it as gospel, but they can change their view. You know, the lady can change her mind. So, and she does quite regularly, particularly when Carney was in charge. So, you know, policy can change, and policy response can change, and then the things they have to respond to can change. So, yeah, I think it's something to watch, but not for this year.
Okay, well, let's come on to some of the comments that you made earlier. You seem to say there that you're expecting quite a strong and sharp economic recovery at some stage. So, you know, do you want to flesh out a bit of that view?
Yeah, absolutely. So, wait, you know, the reaction to this crisis back in, well, I guess it was really in March, was unprecedented. I mean, we always look back to 08 and 09 in terms of the policy response from central banks. You know, Bernanke was in charge, and he had to, you know, reach back into history and learn what he did in the Great Depression or what he didn't do in the Great Depression. And luckily, Bernanke actually wrote a lot of those books, so that certainly helped back then. This time around, they just simply dusted down what they did in 08, 09 and done more and done it faster. So the monetary stimulus was quicker and bigger. And actually, the fiscal stimulus eventually also looks like in continental Europe has been fairly effective. So We're seeing huge stimulus and very quickly. So, and in terms of what this means for the global economy, typically it takes up to 12 months for monetary stimulus, or actually maybe slightly longer sometimes, for monetary stimulus to have its full impact on the economy. So if they started doing lots of stimulus in March, then by next year you should have the full impact of that. But even immediately you get some benefit. So monetary stimulus happens pretty quickly. Fiscal stimulus, if anything, is even quicker. And you know, we saw a lot of fiscal stimulus. You know, deficits clearly have been are going to be massive from this crisis. And that means that what you see is, you know, with about a bit of a lag, but towards the end of this year, that should alone result in stronger growth. So the other point I mentioned was energy prices. We have some economic models that we run, which have shown that oil prices in particular, when they soar, then you normally get much weaker growth about 6 months later. And that's because oil prices, it's a cost of production for companies, and it's like a tax almost for a consumer. So if you have a collapsing, if you have a soaring oil price, then that's bad news for anyone other than energy companies. But then on the other hand, if you have a collapsing oil price, you tend to find 6 months later you have a surge in growth, given that it's like a tax cut effectively for a consumer, or a big drop in production costs for a company. But given that we had that collapse in oil back in March and then again in April, then that suggests that, you know, in sort of October time, we should have a decent bounce back in economic activity. So it feels a bit like the stars are aligning from going from an extremely bearish, obviously hit a massive shock to the economy in the spring, to a big rebound in activity towards later this year in Q3 and particularly in Q4. And that means that, you know, when everyone talks about the shape of the global recovery, and it's something I've never fully understood why people always attribute letters of the alphabet to the economic recovery during a recession. And if they do an alphabet, it's always the Western alphabet. Why is it not some other, you know, written language? But anyway, it's people talk about V's, W's, L's, U's, T's and try and come up with something new and funky. But no, we thought even in February, before we hit the worst of the crisis, it would probably be a capital V, you know, really big slowdown, which wasn't priced in at all in January. And then a really big rebound, which clearly wasn't priced in at all in March, because everyone was pricing in a depression. So I think our view hasn't really changed. And this was really contingent on coronavirus becoming less of a problem for markets and going away. And we saw evidence of that even at the end of March. You know, everyone was talking about what you got to look at is the rate of infections, and then everyone panics and forgot about that. But I think that's come back again. It's, you know, the change in the infection rate is what you've got to look at to drive what's going to happen to the global economy, what's going to happen to the global economy. And the rate of infections had been slowing all through Q2 until really the middle of June. We did expect some kind of second wave. As people go back to work, then it's inevitable you're going to have some pickup in infections. I would say, though, that in the US, the situation has deteriorated faster than what we would have expected a few months ago, although it's probably better than what we expected in Europe and Asia, at least in East Asia. Southern Asia is slightly worse position. So, you know, broadly speaking, it's followed what we expected, even back in March and April. But I think the risks have increased a bit. So when we look at markets, and, you know, referring back to your first question about what markets are pricing in and different markets pricing in different things, we do think that that we're still risk on within our portfolio. We still think that risky assets are pricing in bad news, and there's a lot of monetary support, and I think growth is going to improve anyway. The risks have escalated. So that means that you know, if the valuations are unchanged and the risks have increased, then you should be de-risking. And that's exactly what we've been doing in the last few weeks in our portfolio. We were very overweight credit. In fact, we were as long of corporate bonds as we could be within our mandate in our strategic bond fund, which served us very well in Q2. But we have been reducing that quite aggressively in the last few weeks, while markets were still pretty well bid. And also we've been increasing some of the hedges we have, where if there is a second wave, if there is another slowdown, and it goes from being a few localized lockdowns to something wider spread, then, you know, we want to have some more risk-off hedges within our portfolio. And that's what we're doing, particularly within currencies, where we think that currencies are pricing in not much bad news.
Okay, well, that's interesting. We'll come on to that in just a moment. I guess the obvious question, though, is this crisis being so different from previous ones, does it have more of a supply side element to it? You know, taking the energy prices example that you gave earlier, you know, is there such a big boost to the economy from falling energy prices if actually people don't really have the need or the opportunity to kind of go places and do stuff?
Yes, I think on this kind of question, I guess ultimately, you know, we're talking about you know, inflationary risks as well. There was actually a paper on this from the Fed, it was published fairly recently, looking at, well, specifically the kind of aggregate demand and supply effects of coronavirus or COVID-19. And I think the, you know, what the paper highlighted obviously was that you know, there are factors that are driving you know, inflation higher and from the supply side, but also lower from the demand. Now, they found actually that the impacts on the demand side are both bigger actually and less reversible, if you will, so bigger and more permanent. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, when we're looking at you know, inflation, you know, you have a lot of people who, you know, have been asking us, you know, are you worried about kind of this kind of inflationary spiral, anything like that? And actually we're not. And that is obviously because of exactly what the Fed paper here is saying. Ultimately, the recessionary impact on inflation can be, you know, more negative than the inflationary that we get from the supply constraints. Now, that doesn't mean that inflation markets aren't good value. In fact, we have been long on TIPS, for example, or U.S. inflation and European inflation, and that's not because of a view that we're going to get some sort of hyperinflation. That's simply because in the fallout from coronavirus, you know, in February, March, what we saw, you know, really across the board was even negatively priced inflation. And in the US, as an example, I mean, two year implied inflation in the US got to around sort of minus 40, minus 50 at the very lows. So our view wasn't that we're going to get hyperinflation, but just in fact that what the market is pricing is probably unrealistic, given all the easing that's out there. And I guess bringing it again back to your first question about squaring that circle, I mean, one of the reasons why we've seen credit spreads rally, why we've seen implied inflation go higher, why we've seen equities go higher as well, is those very are those very low yields that we see in government bonds, because ultimately that is the key way that central banks can affect the economy. That is the way monetary policy works. It works via lowering rates and or buying government bonds and now corporate bonds as well. So I think one is driving the other, and I think it's fairly clear from you know, what we're hearing from the Fed, from the ECB and others, that they will be around for a longer time. And again, so that's, you know, for us, when we're thinking about, you know, asset price performance and not just economic performance, that's pretty bullish for inflation markets, for credit spreads, etc. And again, just to add on to that, is one more thing as well. You know, when we're looking at a lot of our models, the assumption that we tend to use is, you know, we look at what the Fed is buying or what the ECB are buying, and that they're going to continue. Now, you can assume that they're going to taper off, but you can actually also assume that they're going to continue, or in fact, they're going to increase. I think one thing that's often forgotten, and I think, you know, it's something that the ECB and the Fed have been stressing, is that they can increase things as well. So again, if the market doesn't recover, if the economy doesn't recover as much as people would hope, then they can, of course, increase that support. And I think the key thing to look for here is inflation. You know, we were discussing the other day, what would happen if the Fed or the ECB kind of put the foot on the brake. But I think for them to do that, you'd have to see inflation much, much higher. So I think for now, in that environment, in the environment where the demand side is still pretty weak, then the central banks are still going to be around and could in fact even increase their presence.
Okay, let's talk a bit about the hedges then that you've put in place, and you mentioned particularly in the FX market. So, is that's the dollar and the yen? Is it?
It's a combination of things that we've been looking at, and we've been obviously adjusting these as markets react. But I guess when you're looking at these hedges, you're looking for really a couple of different things. So first of all, you're looking for things that will ultimately react to some of the concerns that you have. So if we're talking about a second wave or a broad risk off move, then you're looking for the high beta currency. So in developed markets, these are things like the Australian dollar, actually sterling as well, which people don't always necessarily realize. So Canadian dollar as well, partly because of its links to oil, but also being a commodity currency in general, it's a very high beta market. So these have been some of our favorites. Now you also then have to consider what has, you know, valuation. So when you look at, you know, Mike mentioned the V shape. So you see actually in things like the Australian dollar versus the dollar or the Australian dollar versus the yen, you see that's done a full V, even gone a little bit higher at one point relative to the beginning of the year. So again, from a valuations perspective, you know, that has fully recovered. It's done a full V. So it makes sense for us as a hedge then to be short there. And then of course you have to think about, you know, how best do you express these views. So in developed markets actually, volatility, option implied volatility has fallen back, especially from at the money options again. So from the developed market side, our hedges have been structured in options because again, they have been cheaper that way. Now, the other thing that we've been doing on the hedging side, especially on the currency side, is emerging markets. I think our view has been probably quite a popular view, which is that, you know, developed markets have the sort of the policy support both from the fiscal side and the monetary side. Emerging markets have less ability for that type of support, and also of course on the health front, perhaps less ability to fight the virus. And I think we've seen that in action in a couple of places like Brazil and Mexico. So for us, again, being short emerging markets has been another way we want to hedge the portfolio. And that's usually done via forwards. The implied volatility is a little bit higher there. So it makes more sense doing it via forwards, with the notable exception of the Philippine peso, which is now again, it's actually stronger on the year versus the dollar than it started, and implied volatility is almost back to where it started. So it's a combination. You know, and lastly, I think probably worth mentioning, it is the Japanese yen. It hasn't really been doing much over the last few months, but then again, risky assets have done fairly well. It's one of those currencies where investors, they lose faith a little bit, and we saw that in February, where dollar yen actually went higher initially when the coronavirus crisis was starting, and there was discussion that the yen is no longer a safe haven. But it is a safe haven, and you know, key reason for that is still there, which is the Japanese have a huge external surplus relative to the rest of the world, a net investment position very, very positive there, which means ultimately when there are fears in terms of coronavirus or global economic weakness, asset prices, there's lots of assets that are sent back to Japan, and there's causes a lot of buying of the yen. So the Japanese yen remains a firm favorite of ours, and again we've got long positions there as well. I don't know if Mike wants to add to anything to that, because we do also have some shorts in terms of European periphery that are specifically relative versus our credit positions.
Yeah, it would be good to get your view on that, Mike. I mean, I just by way of kind of context, I think something that that we've heard from a lot of fund managers recently is just it is a kind of reappraisal of the Eurozone, with the amount of the amount of support from different European states for the European recovery fund. And this is perceived as perhaps like implying a new sense of unity among European states, and possibly even a new euro convergence trade. So is that something that that you disagree with?
A step on the right path, but I wouldn't say this now means that Germany is underwriting Italian government bonds. So we're a very long way from that, just support for periphery, where you get essentially Italian yields then moving back to where they were pre 2009, 2008. I mean, when we look at it, actually, I'd say it's priced in. And if you look at valuations and you know, what markets are pricing and what risks, one of the key risks to the Eurozone, obviously, from this year is that what were already high government debt levels in countries like Italy in particular are now a heck of a lot higher. Italy is triple B rated, and going into this year, its public debt to GDP ratio was in the mid-high 130s as a percentage of GDP. The Italians themselves expect their debt to GDP ratio to get towards 160%, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was more than that, and then potentially 170% or higher at some stage next year. So, yes, there is some joint issuance being talked about, but I still think it is highly likely at some stage, not probably this year, but maybe next year or even the year after, that Italy gets jumped. So within our portfolio, we're risk on. You know, we're supported for risky assets, so like I said before, less so. But we think about what the key risks are, and Catherine mentioned emerging markets we think are particularly vulnerable to a renewed slowdown in the global economy, or just if we're wrong in terms of what happens to the global economy. But I think another key risk for markets could be a rerun of the Eurozone debt crisis, because I think whatever measures the ECB puts in place or whatever kind of fiscal union is discussed, the markets will not be prepared for Italy getting jumped. And I think there's a big risk of that, because Italy's got over 2 trillion euros of debt, and there's going to be a hell of a lot of forced selling of Italian government bonds as it moves from investment grade to sub-investment grade at some stage, assuming that does happen at some stage. So I think that's a key longer-term risk for us, is that that the risks of a Eurozone debt crisis rerun have picked up. And the authorities in Europe did initially drop the ball. You know, there was the first reaction from Northern Europe was basically, well, it's your problem, Italy and Spain, and you can deal with it. And then they quickly realized that was going to tear the Eurozone apart. So they have changed course a bit. But the reality is right now, if you look at Italian government bonds versus Germany, now the spread on 10-year Italy over Germany, it got to almost 160 basis points a couple of weeks ago in sort of mid-late June, which is exactly where it was before this crisis started. And it's also about half the level of spread that we saw in 2018. And bear in mind, in 2018, what caused Italy to do really badly, it was trading at 320 basis points over Germany at one stage, was whether Italy would have a deficit of 2.1% or 2.4%. And they had a bit of a battle with the EC. So everyone started panicking, thinking Italy's going to try and leave the Eurozone. I mean, now it's going to be having a deficit of 10% or more than that. And yet valuations are half in terms of risk premium or spread are half of what they were. So it feels to us like the risks of some kind of crisis have actually increased, but the valuations have moved the other direction. So we think within risk-off hedges in our fund, even if the recent chat and support from Northern Europe has been favorable, we think that the long-term risks have increased. And given the valuations aren't pricing that in, then we have some quite big risk-off hedges to hedge the portfolio against some kind of Eurozone breakup risk. We are short Italy 10-year futures, short France, short Spain. Very cheap to do so, to have these positions on. And within currencies, we have a bit of a short euro, again, versus the yen. That's a trade that worked really well in 2011 when the euro had a big wobble on the Eurozone debt crisis. And, you know, running scenario analysis suggests that we are immunized from that shock.
Okay. All right. Well, listen, guys, I think we could carry on talking all day, but I think we do need to wind this up. So let me just say thanks very much for sharing those views with us and the podcast listeners. And thanks also to all of our listeners for joining us. Hopefully you found this a useful podcast, and we really hope that you'll join us again next time as well.